Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
2.7 million Wisconsin voters will be mailed an absentee ballot application on September 1. Governor Tony Evers gives more than $80 million in federal pandemic relief to K-12 schools, the UW system, and private colleges and universities. University of Alaska System President Jim Johnson withdraws as a candidate to run the UW system. He says Wisconsin officials have important process issues to work out. And how did the first online state Democratic Party convention go? Rewind, your week in review for June 19.
I'm Joey R. Ross.
I'm Jesse O'Poyan.
Welcome to Rewind. A week look at This Week in Politics. Jesse, I want to start with the Elections Commission. Almost, not quite, but almost there on sending absentee ballot applications. And again, applications, not ballots, to 2.7 million registered voters. So just what we hear from the debate this week, Jesse, discussion, what's the significance of doing this, of sending out that many ballot applications?
What we've seen in the April election here, what we've seen in elections conducted in other states is that no matter where we are at this point in COVID recovery, that's going to be an issue going forward. And everyone's kind of trying to avoid the mess, for lack of a better word, that occurred on in that April spring election heading into November. So, the hope is to encourage as many people as possible to vote by mail. You've got maybe some partisan disagreement over whether it's best to just send out the ballot or send out the application. It seemed like, for the most part, sending out that application was a reasonable compromise. Only a handful of folks in the Republican Party who were opposed to doing that.
Yeah, important to note that the last thing they got to do, the commission, is finalize some language. The mailer is pretty much queued up. And so let's look at a clip right now, or listen to a clip right now from this week's discussion about that process, sending out those 2.7 million absentee ballot applications.
Is there further discussion on the adoption of the letter and the form with the amendments as we have gone through here today?
This is Bob. I have one comment. I'm going to go ahead and vote for it. But I think that, we're being somewhat loose with the what the law says on this. I believe that when it says written application, it really implies a signature. But I think we've been through that, and Megan has put forth an argument, I guess, that's not required. And my attempt today was to try and get it clear. And I think every time we can be clearer and more exact in these things, that we're better off and avoid this. And I think this is something this direct mail piece is something that is good for both the Republicans and for the Democrats.
Commissioner Bostelman.
Hi.
Commissioner Glancy.
Hi.
Commissioner Knudsen.
Hi.
Commissioner Spindell.
Hi.
Commissioner Thompson.
Aye.
And Commissioner Jacobs votes aye. We have unanimously approved that.
Now, Jesse, you kind of hinted at that partisan disagreement, a little bit of one this week about sending out these applications. Rick Gundrum, a Republican from Slinger, circulated a letter among his colleagues trying to get them to sign on to protesting this move. From what we got out of Gundrum this week, his local clerks were worried about the burden, the work burden of doing this. But the commission said, look, this is all about trying to lessen the burden on you guys. We're going to take care of it. What's the significance of these guys, of the small batch of Republicans opposing this mailer, especially just because I heard from Republicans that, look, Democratic mayors in Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, now in Wausau, are probably going to send out these absentee ballot applications. So the Republican thought I heard was, hey, if they're going to send them out to their voters, we should have them sent out to our voters as well in rural areas where it's a lot likely clerks can do it on his or her own. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point to highlight. There are going to be municipalities that have more of an infrastructure to take care of this on their own and would probably go ahead and do it regardless of what the commission did. I think it's always worth listening to hear what local clerks have to say throughout the state, because I think at the end of the day, legislators are pretty responsive to that for the most part, because those are the folks who are, you know, helping administer the elections back home. So, I mean, to lessen that burden, take that burden away from a community that doesn't have the infrastructure that, say, Madison or Dane County have, I think that's the end goal here, right? Because the local clerks and administrators are going to be burdened no matter what. And I think the idea here is to try to take that off the back end or rather insert that into the back end and not have a situation like we had last time where we're waiting days to find out results and we're concerned about safety at the ballots.
Yeah, I think the big thing, though, I think out of that meeting this week was that the commission deadlocked on a request from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a conservative group, to ban so-called harvesting of absentee ballots. That reason why I say it's a big thing is because I think it's going to end up in a lawsuit. Sooner or later, I think we'll go to court and ask for a court order. That gives point of view. Now, there's a little bit of disagreement about what the law says. There are, for example, exceptions in the law. Harvesting is where having a third party either request an absentee ballot or return it for a voter. Now, there are some exceptions. So, for example, if you are in a nursing home, you're allowed to have somebody help you with the absentee balloting process. During the commission meeting, a couple of commissioners then pointed and said, look, this isn't a problem. Right now, there are some, the way it's been interpreted so far is that, yeah, harvesting, you know, on widespread is not really allowed. But, for example, if a wife requests an absentee ballot, her husband can mail it back for her, return it for her. If you change that, that's going to cause a lot of confusion. Why is this a big deal to you, Jesse?
Well, I think the confusion is exactly the point. I mean, kind of going back to, there are so many questions, so many things up in the air about what our election is going to look like, whether it's, is it going to be mostly in person? Are we going to be able to get these ballots out? What's going to happen with the purge of the voter rolls that's up there? And so that this just adds to the confusion of that, of, you know, this thing that hasn't typically been a huge deal. Like you said, it's generally like someone in a nursing home or maybe a spouse mailing a ballot for someone. If that starts coming into question, you're just throwing more chaos and confusion into the mix. But I do agree with you. I do think this is going to go to court. Will has certainly not been shy about taking things to court in the past, and they've got a pretty decent track record on getting their side through in the court. So it does seem like that's probably where this is going to be headed.
And don't forget, it's all playing out against the backdrop of the president now saying in a national media interview that the biggest threat to his reelection is a mail-in election, that if that happens, things are going to be a problem. So topic two, Jesse, Steve, I learned a lesson last week when we tape early on a Friday. Sometimes things develop later in the day. We were sure at 9 o'clock last Friday morning that Jim Johnson was all queued up to become the next University of Wisconsin president. But in the span of 7 days, Johnson withdrew from the process, and now we have former Governor Tommy Thompson, who's going to be the interim UW president. Now, a couple of things to note about this. The search for permanent placement won't start for a year. Thompson, according to the university, requested the minimum salary for a UW president, which is $489,334. Regent President Andrew Peterson, a Walker appointee, made the appointment of consulting with the board. Here's a quote from Andrew Peterson. Governor Thompson is a statesman who offers the kind of leadership the UW system needs right now. Now, I think it's interesting to point out that the Board of Regents right now is controlled by Walker appointees, but it's going to flip to Evers appointees sometime next year. Very important, I thought, in the release today that Karen Walsh, an Evers appointee, also praised Thompson as a pragmatic leader, saying, he has my confidence. One thing to note, under university policy, interim appointments can't seek the permanent appointment unless they get a waiver. Now, Jesse, you know, I've been up here for a few years covering politics in Wisconsin, and every time there's an opening for UW president, Tommy Thompson's name floats. But I've never seen him be a serious contender. This is kind of the culmination of a lot of years of speculation about Tommy Thompson leading UW, especially he's a huge cheerleader for the system when he was governor 20-some years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, going back to the days of Scott Walker as governor, anytime he proposed something, some sort of cut to the UW budget, you would generally hear Democrats say, well, you know, Tommy Thompson didn't do this. Tommy Thompson, our last Republican governor, he would never do this. And so I think you're going to be hard-pressed to get a lot of criticism from Democrats on this right now because they've spent so much time looking back to those sort of good old days, golden years, because he was a huge champion for the UW system. And he was sort of a natural name to float every time there was an opening. And I haven't heard a lot from Democrats yet. The only statement I've seen come from a Democrat has been from Fred Rister, who, again, that carries some weight as he's been around for a little while, too, and knows the history of the system. And I agree. I think it's really significant that that Karen Walsh put her confidence out there and got the backing. I mean, it hasn't felt like there's necessarily been an incredibly united front or a lot of organization on this search. And this seems like a pretty quick effort to right that ship and maybe stabilize things a little bit going forward. But like you said, the interesting dynamic to keep in mind is, you know, the control is going to flip pretty soon and you're going to have a lot more of that cooperation.
Well, you know, when Jim Johnson withdrew last week, he really knocked the process. Basically said they have some things to work out there at UW system. That's because faculty and staff had criticized a search process that produced him as the only finalist. They were not included in that search committee. They didn't like the fact there was only one person to consider. Even so, the thought I heard was that as long as Johnson didn't fall down in these interviews, he was going to be the guy. He was going to get the pick. Obviously, he saw the budget problems we're facing here in Wisconsin, the environment that he was possibly walking into with faculty and staff unhappy. And oh, by the way, that board control flipping in a year, and probably thought, you know, there might be better things to do with my time. Also worth noting that a week ago, Peterson, who now is praising Tommy Thompson, said, this is a dark day for UW with Johnson pulling out. What I'm wondering going forward is, okay, they have Tommy Thompson to kind of take the helm for, let's say, a year. Who are they going to find in the meantime? What challenges will he or she face and taking over, because we still have a pandemic to deal with and budget cuts. So this is maybe not the most enticing job in the world right now. I mean, do you see any roadblocks to finding a top-notch candidate for UW at this point?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's not unique to Wisconsin, certainly, that the COVID is going to present budget challenges to any state-funded university system. But I mean, the fact is that we've already been having budget challenges with the university system for years. And no one wants to come in and have to make a decision to, you know, consolidate a campus or to, you know, implement hiring freezes or layoffs or anything like that. And it's not good for faculty morale. It's not good for student recruitment. It's not good for rankings and throughout the country. And you know, it's hard to imagine anyone coming in and taking that job and coming out of it well-liked, no matter how they handle it. So I think that kind of adds to the significance of Tommy Thompson coming in and taking it, because you're basically taking one of the most popular political figures in Wisconsin history, putting him in a position where he may have to make some tough choices that don't sit well with people, but maybe he's able to do that in such a way that the next person coming in has a little bit less of a mess to clean up, and maybe it's a little more attractive.
So let's move to some more breaking news today, Jesse. So we have June 9th, we got a letter from the Wisconsin Legislative Black Caucus urging Governor Evers to call a special session on policing reforms. There's a national debate going on right now. There is a bill moving its way through the U.S. Senate, one through the House, about the same topic. But the Black Caucus said, hey, we want to see something happen here in Wisconsin. A couple days ago, Assembly Democrats backed the call from their colleagues for a special session. Governor Evers, though, today announces he's calling for a package of bills, but not calling the special session. Before I get to the bills, Jesse, I mean, special sessions, a governor can call a special session, but he or she can't force lawmakers to meet, right? So, but there had been something symbolic about calling it, because the Black Caucus wanted it called on Juneteenth. There's a symbolism, I think, to them of like having this call for Friday, June 19th. The idea of Republicans coming in and gaveling out quickly would have been, to them, a bad one for them. I mean, this national debate about Black Lives Matter and doing it on Juneteenth Day, why do you think the governor passed on calling a special session?
Well, look how the last few special sessions have gone. I mean, that's exactly what would have happened, right? You would have had to gavel in, gavel out. The timing, there hasn't been enough conversation, I don't think, on the back end at the legislative level to have anything really ready. And so there couldn't have really been any substantive debate. And we also see that, I think, like, once again, relations between the two parties kind of seem to keep hitting all-time lows, you know, week after week. And you know, given, you know, what's happened at other times when there seemed to be, you know, a lot of momentum and a lot of support, a really crucial moment. I mean, gun control sort of being the key issue here. There's just not a lot of willingness, a lot of cooperation. Republicans are certainly not interested in being told what to do by Governor Evers. And maybe an olive branch, maybe just an effort to try to, you know, to not force another one of those conflicts where you can't come back from it. I mean, maybe there's real hope here. That's the cynic in me has a hard time with that, but maybe there's some real hope that because this is an issue that has had bipartisan support before in the legislature, maybe the way to do it is actually by taking the time and doing that work behind the scenes rather than, you know, coming in and having that big show of things and then not really being able to go forward from that.
Now, worth noting, I think that usually we get releases from Governor Evers by himself speaking about legislation. This one was issued jointly with Lieutenant Governor Manuel Barnes, only elected statewide African-American official in Wisconsin. They did note in their release and in a letter they sent to the Black Caucus that, you know, calling a special session, quote, where legislative leaders come in and gavel in and gavel out, risk us losing this incredible moment in history where we can and should be able to work together to get something accomplished. So maybe to your point, Jesse, about getting something done, maybe they can put some effort in. Now, a couple of highlights of this package from what the governor put out. He wants statewide use of force standards. This discussion has been going on. He called for AB 1012 a couple weeks ago, which has a similar provisions in there. That one would require that the use of deadly force by police in Wisconsin would be a last resort. Another bill would require law enforcement officers annually complete at least 8 hours of training on use of force. Another bill, $1 million grant program to fund community organizations. Another bill requiring law enforcement agencies to develop policies prohibiting use of chokeholds. Another bill on policies by use of force. Also, a couple other pieces in there. Now, we also, right after I got this one in my inbox, Jesse, I got a bill from Republican Representative Jim Ott and Republican State Senator Pat Tustin. Now, I don't know if this is the GOP answer yet to the package the governor and Lieutenant Mandela Barnes put out, but it is a proposal from two lawmakers on a very similar topic. Theirs is much more tailored, though. One bill would require the Law Enforcement Standards Board to regulate jail and juvenile detention officer training standards and regulate recruitment standards for new officers. Also would require changes to training. So I guess I'm wondering, Jesse, do you see them coming in between now and January 3rd or 4th, they actually have a new session, to do something like this? It is obviously a very important topic, but they're not in session right now. The governor can't force them to come to the table. Do you think Republicans will agree to come in and take up a bill?
That's a good question. You know, looking at the authors on that Republican bill you mentioned, Tustin and Ott certainly have been pretty productive members of the legislature, but also, you know, have been productive because they work across the aisle. And it's not clear to me, you know, how much buy-in there is from maybe members of the party who have a harder time working across the aisle. If there's more legislation coming out, if there's something, I mean, it's noteworthy that this is coming out from those two legislators and not coming out from the caucus as a whole, right? And it's not coming from Fitzgerald or Voss. And so you don't really know that the support's there unless you're getting a rollout that's a caucus-wide initiative. And until we see that, I'm a little skeptical. But again, encouraged that we're, you know, getting ideas that are coming out that seem to not contradict each other, not conflict with each other. I mean, the proposal that they talked about has had bipartisan support in the past when similar things have been introduced. But I mean, look at previous efforts at police reform. I mean, in particular, you know, the bill that Chris Taylor and Gary Baez, I don't even remember how to pronounce his last name, but that bill that came out years ago, I mean, that took so long to get anywhere on that. And it's been so long since that happened, and we haven't seen more action. I'm not really counting on anything happening between now and January, especially because it is such a crucial campaign season.
Worth noting that Ott is perhaps the top or one of the top Dem targets this fall. Dems don't have many targets in the state Senate this fall because the map isn't great for them, but if there is one, it's probably Pat Tustin. So guys who do have a little bit to lose this fall, I don't know if that's why they put the bill out, but worth noting about their background. So next topic, Jesse, I think we're all in the middle of a political whodunit at this point in the Capitol, all right, about this taped phone call with Governor Evers and the two top Republicans. So now, this story broke last week, and if people forgot, Governor Evers, somebody on his staff, taped a phone call that the governor had with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Republican from Rochester, Senator Leader Scott Fitzgerald, Republican from Juneau, where they were discussing a possible rule package to replace the stay-at-home order that had been struck down by the Supreme Court the previous day. That tape was released under open records request, and it prompted outcries from Republicans who called the governor Nixon ask for taping this conversation. The governor said he didn't know about it. Robin Voss said he didn't know about it. Scott Fields said he didn't know about it. So the question is, Jesse, who knew about it? And why is that important? Because this week, Fitzgerald put out a memo from the Reference Bureau, basically said that if a party on a call did not authorize the taping, it's a felony. Jesse, why is this a big deal?
Well, I mean, it's obviously potentially a big deal because it could result in a felony. I mean, it seems more likely that someone on the call did authorize it and they just don't want to say who it is. But, you know, it's not great if the governor authorized it. And it's also maybe not great if the governor didn't know that someone on his staff was doing something like this. You know, it's one of those, like, which is worse? I don't know. It's not a great situation for them to be in. And you know, in terms of a news cycle, you know, Speaker Voss was reported on saying something about, you know, the immigrant population in Racine County that I think, you know, had it not been under the shadow of a secretly recorded call, might have been a bad news cycle for him. But, you know, until you find out how did this even get out there and how did this call get recorded, it's kind of hard to focus on anything else. I don't know why. I don't know why they're not just saying who did it. It seems like maybe you just do that at this point and move on. But you know, it's at worst, it's a felony. At best, it's another sign that there's absolutely zero trust in the Capitol between these elected leaders.
Yeah. So five people spoke. So Governor Voss, Fitzgerald, Maggie Gow, Chief of Staff, Ryan Nielsiston, Chief Legal Counsel. So that whodunit, Jesse, is okay, if the governor didn't know, Voss didn't know, Fitz didn't know, then either Maggie or Ryan had to have known, otherwise you're potentially a felony. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I couldn't tell you if there is some kind of loophole that I don't know about or some way to get out of this. But to your point about, like, why don't they say who did it, people I've talked to wondered, is that because they don't want to put Maggie or Ryan in a position of getting criticized? Because the other thing is, we've had bipartisan calls to fire the person who authorized this without the governor's knowledge. So you could be putting either Maggie or Ryan in a difficult position that way. I don't know at this point, even if the governor did discipline his staffer for this, that it would take care of the issue. But that might go a long way to repairing or beginning to repair the relationship, to take some kind of action. That said, not going to happen so far. And here's a quote from Scott Fitzgerald about this. Quote, if the governor didn't know that his staff was recording him, this is a bigger problem than he thinks. If one of his staff committed a felony, he needs to hold that person accountable. So your point, it's bad either way for the governor. Either he knew and let it happen or didn't know, it looks bad that way, right?
Yeah, and I guess there is the other possibility that those people spoke on the call. Was there someone else who was listening on the call who authorized the recording? And what does the law say about that? Do you have to be an active participant in the call to give consent, or can you just be on the line and have no one know that you're there but be the consenting party?
Yeah, again, not a lawyer, don't want to touch that one, but it seems like a problem for somebody. All right, so next topic. You know, speaking of problems with the governor, Jesse, the unemployment insurance program, the delays in filling claims continues to bedevil the Evers administration. A couple things happened this week. One, Steve Noss, state senator from Whitewater area, he called for Mark Ryle, who is the UI division administrator, to be either to resign or be fired. Van Wangard, also Republican senator, this one from Racine, both of them on the Labor Committee, backed that call. It's all about this backlog in UI claims. So what we want to talk about this is these numbers are big, but I don't think from talking to people, the Evers administration did a good job defining this issue and what the size of the problem really is. Because here's a rundown, all right? We have had 3.2 million weekly claims filed in Wisconsin since March 15th. Now remember, I said weekly. That's not people, it's weeks of unemployment they're seeking. Of those, 2.3 million have been paid, all right? Now there's where we get the backlog. We call it the backlog. Some people do. About 860,000 weeks that haven't been paid yet. Here's how you break it down even more. Of those, 373,000 roughly have been denied because the people who applied aren't eligible. That leaves with 485,942 weeks as of this past week still haven't been paid. The people have applied. We think they're eligible. They're being processed, haven't got it. Of those, Jesse, 151,000 Wisconsinites roughly have applied for those weeks. Do some math, which is always dangerous for journalists, but that's roughly 3 weeks of benefits per person. Now, there are going to be extremes. Some people apply for one, some people, you know, for eight or nine, okay? But if you start to break it down, you can see where the EVRS folks have not done a good job defining this issue and allowed Republicans room to start knocking and making that bigger number the problem for them. Am I in the right ballpark about that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's worth noting this problem didn't happen overnight. I mean, you can't blame all of this, or it's not even clear how much you can blame of this on the EVRS administration. The problem is when you come in after, you know, years of inaction or actions that hurt a system or whatever the case may be, if the problem explodes under your administration, it's really hard to go back and blame your predecessors for that. I mean, think about Obama and the Great Recession. I mean, that he didn't create that problem, but that's tied to his legacy. So, you know, EVRS inherited this problem. It sounds like there were conversations in February about trying to upgrade the software system, which hasn't been upgraded since the 1970s for processing this stuff. And so, you know, some of the solutions that seem like really common sense solutions, when you've had some legislators, Republican legislators, saying, well, you just need to have people in there taking calls 24 hours a day. Well, apparently you have to shut the system down every night at like 6 p.m. to process the day's claims, because that's how this old computer system works. So, but how effective has the administration and DWD been in communicating that these are the problems that exist and these are why we can't make these seemingly simple fixes that you know, legislators have suggested? It's definitely a communication issue, and it's something that's pretty nuanced. And if you're not someone who's going through the process, kind of hard to really explain or understand how it all works.
Now, pre-pandemic, the Unemployment Insurance Division had fewer than 50 people, I believe, processing claims. By the end of June, between all of the people who've been hired, the third-party vendors will be up to like 1,300. The biggest knock, again, to your point, you know, you can't really blame the EVRS administration for not being prepared for a pandemic, because nobody was. But the biggest complaint that I've heard from both sides of the aisle is, okay, once the governor shut down non-essential businesses with the stay-at-home order in kind of late March, he probably should have anticipated this and maybe started moving people over earlier. If they'd been a little bit more aggressive than moving, maybe it would have helped a little bit. And to that point, quote from Steve Noss, those guys calling for Mark Ryle to be fired, the problem is the complete lack of urgency to get these people either their benefits or denial determinations so they can commence the appeals process. One last topic, Jess, you want to get to. A week ago, Democratic convention. We're going to hear a clip real quick from Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. I mean, my first virtual convention, state convention I've watched. I'll put that up up front. So a little bit different, but the virtual speeches were the kind of news of the day, and we heard from both Biden and Sanders. Biden talking about his, you know, what he wants to do, and Sanders talking about a unity call, because don't forget, those guys are both going out for the nomination not that long ago, and there's still some pockets of Sanders folks who aren't real happy about Biden as the nominee. So let's hear that clip real quick from last week's convention.
We're dealing with multiple national crises, and we need real leadership right now. Leadership will bring everyone to the table so we can take the measures to root out systemic racism. It's time for us to take a hard look at uncomfortable truths. It's time for us to face the deep, open wound of systemic racism in this nation. Nothing about this is going to be easy or comfortable. But if we simply allow this wound to scab over once more without treating the underlying injury, we will never truly heal. We need to stand up as a nation, stand with black and brown communities, come together as one America to deliver justice for all, and I mean all Americans. We need to do this. We can do this. And we will do this.
Let's transform our society so that we have an economy and a government and an energy system and a healthcare system, etc., that work for all of us and not just the few. The absolute need to defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country. And that is that I know that there are folks within the Democratic Party who will have differences of opinion on this issue and that issue. And I certainly am one who does have differences with many others. But at this particular moment, our job clearly must be to elect Joe Biden as our next president and to defeat Donald Trump. And let's all go forward together in doing that.
All right, Jesse, biggest takeaway from the convention, hit me with it.
As we prepare for President Donald Trump to give his first in-person rally, it's interesting to see, you know, how much does a virtual rally really serve to energize the base? What does this mean going into August for the DNC? You know, in terms of pulling it off, went well without a whole lot of technical glitches, went fine, but not really clear, like without that community element, what does a convention really do?
All right, great. No stock picks this week, so that's it for Rewind. I'm J.R. Ross.
I'm Jesse O'Poyan.
That's Rewind for June 19th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.